Welcome back to The Conversation. I'm Bethann Kozlovich. Over the next 10 years, former sugar land owned by the state in central Maui is slated to become a business park. The plan to subdivide 285 acres for light industrial, commercial, nonprofit, and government use is open for public comment until April 7th. The project would become an income stream for the Department of Land and Natural Resources, similar to revenue-generating lands on Oahu and Hawaii Island. I recently talked with Russell Tsuji, the administrator of DLNR's land division, and I asked him how he'd like to see this project develop.
Well, our primary purpose on this one initially was income production to help support our department's natural resource and protection programs. But we do have quite a bit of acres out there, and I know that other departments and agencies are looking for space, and they saw this as a potential opportunity down the road. So we've had inquiries from the federal government and various entities throughout. But again, this is kind of a long process, so it's going to take a while in order to develop this area the way we want to do it.
With all of that, though, are there models that you see from others of your projects that would give an indication of what we might see in central Maui maybe 15 years from now or so?
This one would be a little different in that we have, like, for example, our Sand Island Industrial Business Park out in Sand Island, but that is all private commercial operations. Here, I really think it's going to end up being multiple government agencies out there. The county is already out there. DHHL is near this vicinity across the street, and I understand there are certain legislators are looking possibly to relocate certain state or county functions out there. Yeah.
So we might see buildings, federal buildings, we might see county buildings, we might see some nonprofit organizations out there.
And commercial and light industrial and stuff. So it'd be like a mix kind of.
A real mixed use in there. I mean, yeah. You've got enough acreage when you talk about 285 acres. But I want to talk to you a little bit more about how this streams income into the state, because it seems like your department is one that we don't talk very much about in this way. I mean, your very specific department charged with bringing money into other areas of DLNR.
Yeah, our division, you know, is the land management division, and we try to assist the land board in managing the various lands, the state lands. And we do have our small inventory of leases that we generate revenue from, and with that we support ourselves as well as the other divisions, natural invasives and threatened and endangered species, parks, and Commission of Water Resource Management, etc. Just goes on and on. Yeah, we've been doing this for a while. It's just not necessarily publicized. Yeah.
Why not so publicized?
I don't know. Most people think leasing to commercial enterprises for revenue. They don't see that the tie-in with natural resources, but in the end, we actually use the revenue to help support our programs. So, like in this project here, that's what we're hoping for, the long-term revenue generation to help support DLNR in the long term. Yeah, this project is really something for the future generations of DLNR, the future needs. Yeah.
I wanted to ask you, when it comes to the kind of revenue that you have to generate, both for your own operations and to be able to farm out to other projects and give support, how much are we talking?
An example of 2016 fiscal year, what went to the other DLNR divisions and offices was a little over $4 million. Previous prior years, it's been higher, but last year it was a little over $4 million. The prior year, we funded... when you add in, we actually had to cover the $4 million for the ICUN conference. So that came out of our special fund, which is the rent revenues, together with transferring to the other division. So that year was pretty large. We probably transferred out over $7 million, which included $4 million for the ICUN conference. Yeah.
And how much do you need for your own operations?
Annually, we run, last fiscal year, was roughly about $6 million. For our land division operations, and when I say land division, I include the Office of Conservation and Coastal Lands, which is funded by, 100% funded by our operations.
Meaning that there aren't any tax revenues or dollars coming to you?
That's correct. Not for operating expenses. The only time we get from the legislature and possibly that's geo bond money is when we do the large acquisitions like Turtle Bay or Lipoa Point, etc.
So when it comes to the proposed business park on Maui, what is it that you'd like to see that generate? I mean, is there a certain way that you regard how this land will be developed, not just with some of the federal or state buildings or county buildings that may go there, but is there a nut you have to crack with that?
Well, there'll be entitlement, land use entitlements that we will be needing from the state land use commission as well as county council. But once we even get through that, just to build out the basic infrastructure for this area, water, sewer, you know, and the roads and stuff, we're going to need the assistance of the legislature because that is a very large cost, yeah.
Do you have any idea of what that cost might be for an acreage this large?
I don't have an accurate number that I would feel comfortable sharing at this time, but it is large. It is not insignificant. It is a very significant amount.
You're talking about a bunch of sugarcane areas that has not a whole lot in it right now, right?
That's right. There's virtually no infrastructure. There's no water. Water I'm working on, but there is no sewer capacity, so we'd have to take care of that issue.
But to balance what it's going to cost you to develop this area with what it needs to return to be able to make this a viable conduit of income for other programs, do you have a sense of what this is going to have to return to you to do all of that?
Well, I think for the infrastructure, the basic infrastructure, we're going to be needing the legislature's help on getting an appropriation. So it'll be an investment from the legislature side, but they got to, I think we'd have to convince them that this area is worth investing in, and because of the amount of acres we have, because again, I'm not limiting this area to income production, but we're hoping this area will be an area for other government offices and operations. In fact, our DOFA, our forestry, has an area that it was looking to relocate its base yard at in this park. Yeah. That's since been put on hold for monetary reasons, but we're still reserving that site for them.
Well, before all of this happens, obviously there's going to have to be an environmental impact statement. When will that start?
That's correct. And the ESPIN, the prep notice, has been filed. So we will be going through the process. We're anticipating the EIS studies probably to complete it will take us into probably early 2018. And then from there, we're hoping the next step would be filing a boundary amendment with the State Land Use Commission, and subsequent to that to go through the county entitlements, which would be county zoning and county community plan amendments.
Which I take it will also mean that you'll be having public meetings and engaging the community.
Yes, there'll be many public meetings, yes, and opportunity to comment on the EIS as well.
So with all of this now just at the very, very beginnings of this, if it all moves along reasonably well, and that's I say advisedly, you think that we're going to be looking at a very changed Central Maui within, say, 15 years?
I'm hoping that's the objective and goal, yes, for the future of DLNR. Yes.
All right. Well, I want to thank you very much for the time that you've given us today, and we'll be seeing how this percolates.
Okay. Thank you.
Russell Tsuji is the administrator of DLNR's Land Division. The plan for Central Maui's Business Park is open for public comment, this part of it at least, until April 7th. You're listening to The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, creating an evening of showbiz razzle-dazzle at Manoa Valley Theater. But first, your quiz.
In the glory days of print journalism in Hawaii, newspapers came in a variety of languages to serve the territory's many ethnic communities. In today's backyard quiz, we're reading Hawaii's Portuguese language press of long ago. These newspapers were published for nearly a century, mostly weeklies with relatively small circulation. Articles were usually in Portuguese, but some English language articles and ads found their way onto their pages. So did poetry, letters from readers, even excerpts from Portuguese literature. Our question for this morning, can you name at least one of the past Portuguese language publications. Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer, and you'll get a prize.
Hi, this is Ray Cruz of Latin Beat here on HPR One, thanking you for being with us all these years. Mahalo.
If you're a fan of musical comedy, the art form born and nurtured in the Broadway theater, nothing else will do. Clever lyrics, witty patter, beautiful melodies, these have been the ingredients of Shari Lynn's career, and she'll be celebrating them in a show next month for Mono Valley Theater called Shari Lynn and the Boys on Broadway. She's with us in our studio.
Good morning. I'm tempted to just sing all my comments to you.
I'm tempted to have
good
you.
Morning, yeah. Good morning. Good morning. Okay.
That's a pretty good start. Let's see. Where can we go from there? Right? Any number of places, right?
Good night, my someone. We could.
Well, because the great songs of the Broadway theater are songs that tell stories, right?
Of course, and they're usually topical. But, you know, I'm not alone in this pursuit, in this event, Boys on Broadway. The boys, if I can tell you who they are.
Sure.
Are Kip Wilborn, Guy Marola, Buzz Tennant, Elika Santos. They are extraordinary voices, and they've all sung with opera companies. They're leading tenors who've sung with symphonies. I tell you, my first rehearsal with them was very daunting. There was so much testosterone in the room. But they're true gentlemen, and they did allow me to squeak out a few notes.
Well, so in duets, in chorus, how do you combine?
Yes, we do solos, we have duets, we have trios, and then, in fact, Kip is arranging a song that Streisand, you know, that, what's her name, Streisand? Shirley Streisand or something, yes.
Yeah.
Miss Streisand sang with Il Divo. So it's somewhere from West Side Story. So Kip is arranging that for us.
Oh, boy.
And that's pretty exciting. But everything they're doing is exciting. They're doing about a 75-year retrospective of Broadway history from Fun Home, which is current and on Manoa Valley's next season, Kiss Me, Kate, West Side Story, Les Mis, A Little Night Music, Hello, Dolly, which, of course, Bette Midler is doing on Broadway now. So there's a little something for everybody there. It's also not just Broadway comedy. It's very moving, very, very moving music that is not always light and happy.
Well, that term musical comedy tends to cover things that get away from being funny, right?
But we call it musical theater now, actually.
Yeah.
Sorry, darling.
I will.
Yes, it's musical
henceforth.
Theater now. Yes.
And that's spelled with an R-E, no
It's
doubt.
An R-E. Yes, it is.
Yeah. I'll try to live up with those standards, you know.
So will we.
In the show, you know, you want the show to have a kind of a through line, a narrative, and I'm wondering if you do it chronologically or by the subjects of the songs. Or...
No, Kip Wilborn has put this together. You know, you want a show to have an arc.
Right.
And so you're opening with a very strong, upbeat opener, and then it's a series of peaks and valleys,
mm-hmm.
and he's really put it together beautifully. So there's a bright moments, and then there are beautiful ballads, and then there are very strong masculine moments, and then they leave the stage, and I come out and do my solo and mm-hmm. come back. And Jeanette Trevias is leading the orchestra, so we have a live accompaniment. It's mm-hmm. quite wonderful as well.
So it's all about the pacing of the emotions of the show
rather than a specific narrative. Yeah, we take the audience on a musical theater journey in a variety of ways.
Yeah.
And there should be something for everyone, from the youngest to the eldest, who will remember, may have actually seen the original Oklahoma or something. We were actually talking about that earlier, right?
Well, Oklahoma has some of the greatest songs, doesn't it?
It does. And Rodgers and Hammerstein, of course, created the golden age of musical theater. And Oklahoma is played somewhere in the world every day. Someone is producing Oklahoma.
As well they should be.
And the Rodgers and Hammerstein estate is very thankful for that.
Yeah.
Yes.
Do you have a favorite ballad in this show?
Well, when I hear Kip Wilborn do "Bring Him Home," I melt, as does everyone. It's so perfect for his range, and the song is so beautifully written that it's just really moving. I haven't heard everybody's solos yet, but I will tell you that everybody, Buzz Tennant, Guy Marola, Elika, they all have unique qualities to their voices and to their personas. So everybody will bring something different. For instance, Guy Marola is doing, it's Buzz Tennant who's doing "From Closer Than Ever," a song about his father. Mm-hmm. It tears me up every time. But in contrast, they're opening this show all together with the theme from Guys and Dolls.
I love that song.
Oh, yeah. And that should bring the house down.
When you meet a gent paying all
kinds
of
rent. Yeah, you can bet that he's doing it for some doll. Nothing's changed, right, Chris?
No. That's my favorite show of all time, I got to tell you. Absolutely.
Yeah. Wonderful. Well, maybe we'll see you there.
Oh, quite likely.
Other questions, or are we done for the day?
No, we're not quite done yet. The interrogation continues. I'm wondering what your favorite is to perform.
My favorite musical theater
in this show.
Oh, in this show?
Yeah. What's your moment?
We've only had one rehearsal. We rehearse every Tuesday night. Tonight is actually our second rehearsal.
Uh-huh.
But I'm learning some new material, and often, as musicians, our favorite songs are the ones that we're currently doing, it seems.
Yes, that's right, yeah.
So one of the songs I'm learning is from the new season that Manoa Valley Theater is bringing to us, and it's from Fun Home, which won the Tony. And it's called Days and Days. And it's a woman who has been married for quite a while to a man who has a secret life that she didn't know about.
Mm-hmm.
And she discovers that, and she's singing to her teenage daughter that she doesn't want her to give away her days like she did in this marriage. So it's very compelling. But the song that I love that I ask Kit to do a couple of them, one is Sondheim, Send in the Clowns.
Sure.
Oh, that's one of my favorites. And then a real big belter from Hello, Dolly, Before the Parade Passes By.
Yeah. The standard that was set in the golden age, do you see it, of songwriting in particular?
Yes.
Do you see it being kept up?
Yes. It's just
you
kept
just have
up
to look,
differently.
Huh?
No, it's right there. It's happening all the time. Look at Hamilton.
Mm-hmm.
You must keep theater current. Theater has to reflect current topics so that people of all generations can relate, or else you're just going to have an audience that is expiring and you're not going to be able to fill the seats with new interest. So
yeah.
Theater has to evolve. And sometimes we bemoan the fact that, they don't write them like they used to. No, there will never be another Cole Porter. There will never be another Ira Gershwin or George Gershwin.
Right.
But we have Lin-Manuel Miranda now. And we have other great writers of the theater, and to me currently, and has been for the last 40 years, Stephen Sondheim has been the genius for me.
Yeah.
And from England, of course, the British, different kind of British invasion with Sir Andrew Lloyd Webber. So we still have fabulous writing, songs that are poetic and stirring.
Yeah. Thanks so much, Shari.
You are welcome. Thanks for having us.
Shari Lynn will perform Shari Lynn and the Boys on Broadway on Sunday, April 9th at the Koolau Ballroom. It's a benefit for Mono Valley Theater's annual play production program, and you can learn more about it on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page.
Could financing from a private sector contractor save the beleaguered rail project? According to a report released this week, the answer is yes, times $570 million. CivilBeat.com reporter Chad Blair is back with today's reality check. Hi there. Nice to talk to you. looking at how much the rail is short, I mean, no one is going to sneeze at $570 million, especially if that were to be, you know, packed in with, say, $300 million saved from the skim. Every little bit helps. But really, what is the difference in having a private sector contractor finance this as opposed to how we have traditionally seen the project developed to date with, you know, the design-build concept?
Right. In fact, it has to do exactly with that concept. That's what HART uses. That's where a single contractor is responsible for both designing and constructing the rail line. But this report, which just came out yesterday, said HART could actually be more efficient if it would incorporate project financing for the last 4.2 miles, right? That's going to go to Alamoana Center and the Pearl Highlands Transit Center if they found a private contractor to take care of this. Why? Well, the contractor would have an incentive to get the thing done on time and on budget. Remember those words, on time and on budget?
I do, actually, from a show not too long ago.
Exactly. But also that was the promise from so many people, including Mayor Caldwell, to get this thing done. But the contractor would have the incentive to do that in order to get paid. They would not be paid until the project was done. Essentially, what you're doing is you're transferring responsibility for the rail project, at least these last portions, from the public sector to the private sector. And how nice to be thinking about actually saving $500 million when we're actually looking, as you know, a minimum $2 billion shortfall. Some are saying that shortfall is as high as $3 billion.
A moment ago, you said something that was rather telling. You said, if there can be a private sector contractor who can be found who wants to do this, as far as you know from, you know, the story today, anybody in the wind who might be just that person?
You never know. HART, by the way, cooperated with this report. And I should do a full disclosure here. It's coming from the Ulu Pono Initiative. That's an investment firm that encourages sustainability. And it was founded by our publisher, Pierre Omidyar. So full disclosure there. But HART said, you know, it's interesting. Let's look at this idea of getting somebody else to do it. But they also cautioned that this has not been attempted here. And the savings that you've seen on the mainland or a similar program has been applied may not necessarily happen here. It's not quite sure who would step up to do this. There'd have to be a bidding process. That's going to take time. So all these things kind of point that, well, it might be a little difficult getting someone to come forward and agree to do this, particularly with all the controversy surrounding the rail project. But at least a different perspective on maybe saving some money on rail. Nice for a change.
That's nice, too. But the reality check may be that this may not necessarily be part of our reality.
Yeah, that's right. But a new way of looking at things and the fact that HART is open to it at least reflects well on some different possibilities for finishing the project.
Okay, well, let's hear it for other possibilities, not necessarily alternative reality. Going to talk to you sometime soon.
Thank you, Kellyanne Conway. Just kidding. Alternative facts.
Chad Blair joins us today from CivilBeat.com with a reality check, which we get from them once a day.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the National Kidney Foundation of Hawaii, whose Kidney Cars program provides funding for community health and education services. Learn more about vehicle donation at kidneyhi.org.
There are times when professional work can become public in a totally unforeseen way. UH Vice President for Academic Planning and Policy, Risa Dixon, would fall into that category. Her declarations on behalf of students caught in the miasma of President Trump's travel ban were cited by U.S. District Judge Derek Watson in his order to stop it. Judge Watson didn't reference Ms. Dixon's work only once. He did it seven times. His opinion countered the ban on travel to the U.S. by Iranian, Libyan, Somali, Sudanese, Syrian, and Yemeni nationals for 90 days. In granting the temporary stay, he also stopped the federal government from hitting the pause button on refugee resettlement in the U.S. In part, all of that happened because of the work of Risa Dixon, who joins us now. Hi there.
Hi. Good morning.
Clearly, no one was more surprised than you when you started to get emails from people saying, good job, that's wonderful, and referencing the opinion by Judge Watson. and the fact that you were in it. Did you have any inkling at all that all the work that you'd been asked to do by the AG's office in talking about how this would affect the UH system, did you have any inkling at all that this would wind up in the opinion?
No, actually, I didn't. I knew when we were collecting the information and doing the research that that was going to go into part of the argument for why the travel ban was a bad idea for the state of Hawaii or how it would affect us. But I had no idea that my declaration would be referenced. And I was very, very surprised to see my name in there.
And not once, but seven times.
Yeah.
In the declarations that you sent him, in the work that you did, all of that really focused on what would happen if students were not able to come here from other countries, or if there were some incidents that would be construed as emergencies and family would have to come here, and other reasons that this was a bad idea. What were they?
So for the first declaration, for the first lawsuit, one of our concerns was that we had people on visas who may not be able to move freely because initially with the travel ban, we were seeing people stuck at airports. And so that was one of our concerns because we have not only students but also faculty. And then the concern that students would not be able to come here, students who aren't already here wouldn't be able to come here, wouldn't be able to get visas to come and study, or that, as you said, that family members would not be able to come if the students would need them to be here.
Now that this is out and many people have read it, and it's only about 43 pages or so, but you're in there in the middle part of it, around page 17 or somewhere out of there. Are you concerned that President Trump knows your name?
It's crossed my mind, I have to say. But at the same time, if you're in my position, you have to be really agnostic on these kinds of things. So my concern is really with the priorities of the institution, protecting our students, protecting our faculty. So it is a concern that he knows my name. It is a concern that I've made some kind of an impression in a place that may be uncomfortable for me or that I may not really understand. But really, when it comes down to it, my priorities are to protect the institution, to protect our students and our faculty.
And how do you feel protected by the university?
I guess my job protects me, right? That's an interesting question. In my role, this is one of the things that you do in a role such as this.
What has been the response since this is now out and public, aside from the people who you knew who read it early on and sent you emails saying good job? What has happened for you now that you're more in the public sphere?
Well, it's interesting. A lot of people want to talk, and they want to know my opinion, which, as I tell people regularly, I'm pretty agnostic. I can't afford to have an opinion in my role. It's not my job to have an opinion on this. Like I said, it's my role to protect the institution or to do what's best on behalf of the institution. But I find a lot of people stopping me, wanting to talk. People disagree with me. People agree with me. It's interesting because it's not even really me that they're agreeing or disagreeing with. It's the data, right? I'm just presenting data. How many students we have, how many faculty, how many people on visa, how many applications. So I think it's interesting that people have kind of personalized it to the extent that they feel like they're agreeing or disagreeing with me and somehow I'm related to the decision.
Which seems to be in part what we see happening coming from Washington, too, that the inability to look at data for data and depersonalize it also colors the conversation.
I think that's a human thing. I think we all do that. People disagree with us. We tend to take it personally. We tend to attribute their position to them rather than maybe their function, what it is they're trying to do. So that doesn't surprise me because I think that we do that as human beings.
Were you able to make any headway with some of the folks when you said, hey, look, this is just the data. Take a look at it yourself.
So the kinds of conversations I've had really haven't ended up in those places because people were more interested in me knowing their position. So actually, I ran into a tourist who was from Iran, who had lived in Southern California for 40 years, who had to tell me their family story. And so really much more about those kinds of things.
What are some of the stories that you're hearing? What is elicited from other people?
Well, related to the travel ban or just in general?
Well, in general, as now this is out and you're saying that people are stopping you and telling you their stories, Are there some good stories in there?
Yeah, so the woman I ran into last weekend who was here on vacation with her family, they've lived in Southern California, she told me her family story of how they got over here, how she was brought over as a child, and her family had a hard time coming over. So it's been interesting to hear those stories. One of the questions I get asked a lot, it seems like when people find out that I've been part of this, is, well, why don't these people just be, the people who are already here, why don't they just become American citizens? So I find that an interesting question. Just this sense of, well, if they're here and they're studying, why wouldn't they want to stay? So I think there's always that personal place you're coming from where you don't always put yourself in another person's shoes or perspective.
And understand that perhaps they like living in their country, but they would like to have the freedom to travel and to study in other places, including the United States.
Well, and there are reasons that people would want to come to the United States to travel. We've got wonderful research institutions, particularly Hawaii. We've got wonderful engineering programs. We've got, you know, the best programs in terms of things like ocean sciences and volcanology and all of these natural sciences, plus our other programs. So there are any number of reasons why somebody would want to come study here and then go back either to where they're from or to move to another country.
So now as we're in this place waiting to find out whether this TRO will in fact be made more permanent if the preliminary injunction is granted next week, is there more coming from you? Is there another role for you to play in some of this, in talking to both students and possible students and families who are concerned?
So my role is not to really talk to students or families. I've tried really hard to stay out of that. I've just collected the data for the institution on behalf of the institution for whatever the AG's office may need. Should there be families or students who need to talk, I may not even be the right person. I would tell them to go to their campuses. We have offices that deal with that. But in terms of a future role, you know, that remains to be seen.
We'll wait and see.
Yeah.
Thanks very much for coming in today. Good to talk to you.
Thank you.
And sometimes surprises
they
have
know.
Long-reaching consequences.
Yeah.
We'll see about this one. Thank you, Risa. Risa Dixon is the Vice President for Academic Planning and Policy. Her declarations were cited 7 times in the opinion by U.S. District Judge Derek Watson in his order to stop the travel immigration ban. And it may come to pass that ban is made more permanent if a preliminary injunction sought today is granted next week.
In our backyard quiz for today, we asked you to name at least one Portuguese language newspaper from Hawaii's pre-statehood days. Back then, when you wanted to be in the know, you bought a paper. As a result, several flourished in the islands for nearly a century. The papers served as bulletin boards and ideological rallying points with content provided by community leaders and the editorial staff. They included the late 19th century weeklies O Lusa Hawaiiana, or the Portuguese Hawaiian, and Aurora Hawaiiana, or Hawaiian Dawn, both published in Honolulu. In Hilo, the weekly Aseta, the Arrow, or Ofacho, the Torch, were added in the early 1900s. Those are the possible answers to today's quiz, but doesn't look like anybody got them, so we'll hang on to our prizes, and you can try again another day. If you've got a quiz for us, you can send it to TalkBack at hawaiipublicradio.org. Lori Sumie is a Hawaii-born visual artist and documentary filmmaker whose work is fueled by the kind of research one might more readily associate with a scientist. She's a self-described eco-artist whose concern for the environment and the creatures that struggle to survive within it is central to her work. She has a show opening at Fishcake in downtown Honolulu, and we spoke with her the other day.
As a whole, my recent body of work is about Native Hawaiian species and the conservation of those species. And it's not just, oh, these are really beautiful birds or these really beautiful trees. Like, because of the documentary work I do, I actually spend time in the forest with the scientists and the conservationists. And I've actually, you know, worked on some of the projects, volunteering just to get to experience what's up there that's so unique and so rare to Hawaii. When I grew up here, I had no idea any of this stuff existed. And when you discover it, you're just like, this is amazing that we have this here. And a lot of it is at risk of disappearing, you know, within years. It's not like, oh, in 100 years, this thing will go extinct. Like, it's much more dire. So that work and that research has really driven me to want to do work that exposes some of these really hidden places and stories about these people who are working really hard to save these things.
Well, you know, one might think, Lori, that an artist's perspective on a beautiful bird might be just, that's a beautiful bird, and then, but you can't just walk away when it's an endangered beautiful bird.
Yeah, and it's not that it's just endangered. It's like, you know, there's lots of endangered species all over the world, and you're like, okay, well, these are in Hawaii, and what makes these special? What makes these different? And what I've learned is that there's a cycle of extinction that occurs here, and everyone who works in this field is like, oh, yeah, Hawaii is the extinction capital of the world. I'm like, what? Are you kidding me? You're just saying that because you work here. And they're like, no, it is. And when I did my own independent research, that's true. So, you know, because every, you know, if you're in, you know, the mainland United States or if you're in Africa, like, there's always something that's disappearing because, you know, this
is the world. But people here destroyed more species in a shorter period
yes,
of time.
Yes, the rapid decline of the species here is stunning. And I've interviewed people who have experienced the disappearance of 8 bird species, and they're not that old. They're probably in their 60s and 70s. So I'm like, well, that's crazy. Like, a scientist is more likely to have one, maybe one every 40 years is about the average.
Right.
But in Hawaii, it's about one every 8 years. So that was shocking to me to learn.
Well, but what can you as a visual artist contribute to the effort to keep them alive?
I feel like, you know, in my storytelling with the documentary work and the visual work that I do, it's to sort of contemplate that a little bit. It's not just, this is what this bird looks like or this is what this tree looks like. It's to contemplate how long these birds have been here and how special and incredibly, you know, evolved and unique they are. You know, I've read a lot of Darwin's research, and, you know, I read about what he discovered in the Galapagos. And, you know, the diversity is nothing compared to the Hawaiian birds. And I think knowing how long these birds evolved and how long they've been here and how many have already disappeared, I want to put all of that stuff and all the research and all the stuff I've learned into one single image that sort of captures the gravity of that, because I think it's easy to just say, oh, pretty, beautiful, colorful, like, nice.
Most people who visit Hawaii are pretty much taken in by that and are surprised to learn what a really unhealthy ecosystem it is.
True. And I think most times when people think of a crisis environment, they think of, you know, a leveled forest that's been clear cut or, you know, some kind of rainforest that's been turned into pasture, which has happened in Hawaii. And we don't really have documents to show how much, like, we have so much more pasture and farm than there used to be. But it doesn't look like a devastated landscape because it's very beautiful.
Right.
It's very lush.
It's mostly lush with introduced species.
Yes, lush with introduced species. And once I had, like, native plant vision where I could actually identify the native species versus the introduced, now I look at the forest very differently. I say, oh, this whole area is all introduced, all non-native. And, you know, I think the percentage of native forest is only 8%. And most of that's not that accessible to people. So you have to, in on Oahu, I think you have to hike like 5 hours to get to a really nice native forest. And I'm like, that's crazy.
Lori, I once asked a botanist, as I go through my day and I see all these different plants and flowers, how many of them are native? And he said almost none.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So now that I can identify them, it took me, I mean, part of why I started drawing native plants and species is just so I could learn them. You know, I feel like it's a really intense form of observation is drawing animals or plants and learning what they look like and taking that and then being able to see the real thing and being like, oh, I know what this thing is. That's kind of, it was just for me to learn, to teach myself what's a native species here. And that's kind of evolved into a much bigger body of work that I was not totally expecting when I started.
Well, then you become someone who's in a position to teach others at that point.
I like to think so. I mean, I'm becoming like the bird girl. I've met a lot of the bird folks in Hawaii. I'm getting more into like the seabirds because I've started with the native forest birds. But, you know, once you actually get to see them, they're so amazing. And they're tiny and they're very hard to see. And you have to learn what they sound like to find them. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I had to train myself to like, okay, I got to learn what an amakihi sounds like versus, you know, non-native species. And I have to train my ears before I can even train my eyes to find these things. So that's kind of a lot of work, you know, in some ways.
It's the whole notion of research preceding the artwork.
Yes, I am very, very intensely a research-focused artist. And that, I think the documentary practice feeds directly into the art making because I want to know as much as I can about what I'm making art about. And I want to be as sensitive and nuanced about my subjects. So I just read as much as I can and I talk to as many people as I can. And then I try to distill all of what I've learned into something very, you know, either poetic or just very simple, and not just be didactic and like information and data, which, you know, I still like to read about, but I understand from a visual perspective, like, how do you communicate all that stuff in like a single image, you know, and that's kind of my goal. And I try to internalize it and then put it into the work. And, you know, I'm really happy when I show it to scientists or conservationists and they're like, you totally nailed it. Like, you have the essence of what we're working on and what this species is about, because, you know, there's so much to know and it's an infinite body of knowledge, but I'm always like, ohia is such a fascinating species, and I mean, I just know the tip of the iceberg about that species, so.
So yeah. There's lots of research yet to be done, it sounds like.
I think so. I mean, you know, there's so many even undiscovered species in Hawaii that there are just not enough, like, insect scientists, for example, that they know that there are a lot of species that are just not even described. So it's
all the more reason for you to continue in the direction you're going, right?
Yeah, I mean, I feel like I have a limitless body of interesting things to learn. And I spent a lot of time at the Bishop Museum bugging them and letting me see some of the specimens, because most of it's not public. Mm-hmm. Or just going into the field and going to some very, like, some forest that's not open to the public. Because I was like, and now I have to take what I've seen and learned there and then make it more accessible to people who don't have the fortune of getting to go to these places and seeing them for real, you know. So I feel a responsibility to kind of share what I've seen and know and the knowledge and the stories.
Lori Somie is a Hawaii-born artist and filmmaker whose new show is 36 Views of Mauna Kea, inspired by Hiroshige's 36 Views of Mount Fuji. It includes paintings, prints, drawings, video, and sculpture. It's at Box Jelly on Kamani Street in Honolulu, opening on Thursday, March 30th.
Today, 17 community organizations are readying a rally scheduled for tomorrow morning at the Capitol. The groups will meet to remind lawmakers to support early childhood legislation and other bills strengthening the safety and welfare of the state's youngest members. Deborah Zeisman is the head of the lead organization, Hawaii Children's Action Network, and she's on the phone with us now. Aloha. As you look at some of the bills that are still left alive that deal strictly with early childhood support, which ones are on your list of must-haves for this year?
Well, there's quite a few that we're actually rallying tomorrow in support of, Beth Ann. So I would say our top ones really are about getting more funding into things like preschool subsidies, into our early intervention programs, and as well as into our public and charter school preschool programs.
As we look at a couple of those bills that you just touched on, one of them that appropriates funds for web-based data systems in the Department of Health's early intervention section, that one is still moving. It was passed out of committee last week, but it has amendments, and clearly that means that there is still some more conversation that has to happen with that one.
Yeah, we have quite a few early childhood bills that are still moving, and I think we're rallying tomorrow to really make sure that the community, both the early childhood providers, and we have a number of parents coming out and bringing their kids. It's nice that it's spring break, so a lot of kids are off of school, to really push our lawmakers to invest in the birth to 5 years. So it is things like that early intervention program that we need some more funding to have better data, is that the bill that you just referred to. And to make sure that we have good early detection programs to make sure that if a kid who has a need for like occupational therapy or speech or things like that, that we catch those things early and that the appropriate services are available to get that kid on the right path.
Some of these bills have not yet been scheduled. Are you hopeful that they will be? I mean, we're coming to a point where things are going to get rapidly much more, you know, that they're going to ramp up pretty quickly.
Right. This is a pretty critical week, which is where we need a lot of support. So I think for us, the key issue is that many states are far ahead of Hawaii in terms of investing budget into the early childhood years. And so we're really trying to rally and get more money into our pre-K programs, more money into young children's health programs, things like that, so that all of our kids have the best foundation to start.
A lot of people would probably agree with you in principle when it comes to how do you divide up the money, trying to explain why it would be important, for example, for 0 to 3 court. That might be a little bit more difficult. What do you tell them?
True. I know. I think that's why we need folks to come out. Parents are often kind of an unheard voice, and our kids certainly don't have big lobbyists. So we need people to come out and show their support that these years are critical. You know, it all comes down to budget in the end, and there's many, many important issues. But we think one of the best investments we can make as a community is investment in those babies and getting them ready for kindergarten, setting a solid foundation, and getting them off to a great start.
So what's your assessment of this session so far, if you only look through that lens of early childhood support? How well are lawmakers really focusing on that?
Yeah, there's a decent number of bills this year moving. You know, things for, again, expansion of preschool and charter schools and within the DOE. So not a bad year. I do know, you know, we are looking at some budget constraints. So as we're all concerned that our state has a little bit less money, we need to all be putting our heads together to think about how do we find more revenue and critically thinking about where do we invest. And I think we and also our state lawmakers are really keeping an eye out on the federal budget situation as well. We have a lot of concerns there that our state may see less money coming in for children, for vulnerable families. And that puts our state in a really difficult position if the state is being asked to pick up more of the burden.
And very quickly, and I know this is sort of like maybe choosing your favorite child, but after what you've just said, is there a bill among those still moving that you say is absolutely critical, that if you have to be caught in the whole constraint as everyone else, this is still a must?
Oh, the must. I don't know. There's a several good ones. I think perhaps one of the most important stuff is actually just in the state budget, and that's to expand our public preschool program, which we've been pushing for several years. So it's currently in the House version of the budget, and we're asking folks to keep it in and make sure we can expand and have more public pre-K.
All right. We're going to leave it there, and I know we'll be seeing all of you out at the Capitol tomorrow.
Yep. Thanks so much.
Deborah Zeisman leads the Hawaii Children's Action Network. Tomorrow, HICAN and 16 other organizations will rally at the Capitol at 10:30 in support of legislation benefiting early childhood.
It's time to take a look at what's going on around the state with Morning Edition host and our colleague, Derek Malama. And most of these events are events that might be a little under the radar, but they're pretty interesting. Derek, this is a very inspiring young woman, this first one.
Yes. There is a free film screening at UH Hilo about the youngest person to win a Nobel Prize. He named me Malala is a portrait of Malala Yousafzai, who is an international advocate for the right of all children to have an education. And she was 15 years old when Taliban gunmen shot her in Pakistan. And Malala went on to become the youngest Nobel Prize winner at the age of 17.
And she's only getting started. You know?
Yes, yes. And this film is – I've heard her speak, too, and she's amazing.
You?
Yeah. The film is at 5 p.m. in UCB Room 100, and it's free.
A lot of great things going on for free. And here's one for the history buff.
Yes, history buffs on Kauai will be interested in this one. The Historical Society, Kauai Historical Society Executive Director Helen Wong Smith will discuss the photos, maps, and other historical records relating to the North Shore of Kauai, curated for over a century. It's free, and it's happening in the Princeville Public Library from 5 to 6:30 p.m.
A lot of great stories come out of the history of Kauai, too, mm-hmm. don't they?
Yes.
And it's spring break, so what do you do with the kids, right?
Well, you can take them to a library, believe it or not.
where they're supposed to be quiet.
Right.
That's an excellent idea.
This is happening at the Makiki Community Library near the District Park there from 1 to 4 p.m. They can play bug bingo. I never heard of that. But and other cakey games before the return of the fairy grandmother with her magical story hour at 3 p.m. And all keiki will receive a free book, and all adults will have a choice of a free book or a free DVD.
I think we need to put our research people onto the task of finding out what bug bingo
is. Yes, we'll have the answer tomorrow at this time.
Without needing to bring in any bugs, let's hope.
Right.
Thanks a lot. And that's a free event, too, as well.
Yes, yes, it is free.
Great, Derek. Thanks a lot.
Sure, you're welcome.
Derek Malama joins the conversation to take a closer look at events in our community that are going on under the radar. And you can always find out more on our website, hawaiipublicradio.org.
Hi, this is Sarah Bauer, Sustaining Membership Coordinator for Hawaii Public Radio. Thank you for listening.
Well, that's going to do it for us for today. Coming up tomorrow, contributing editor Neil Milner offers a different view of the healthcare debate.
And the Massey case is reimagined as an opera.
We'd like to know what you think about any of the guests that you hear on the show, today's or any other day. Our talk back line is 808-792-8217, and you can call and leave us your comments anytime you like. You can also email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org or post comments on Facebook. You can find us at Hawaii Conversation. We also tweet as HI Conversation. I tweet at BKOZHPR.
And if you missed any of this show or want a past one, you can find them on the Conversation page with links to more information about guests and topics. Just look under Talk Shows for the Conversation on HawaiiPublicRadio.org. I'm Chris Vandercook.
I'm Beth Ann Koslovich. We hope you'll join us tomorrow and catch more of the Conversation.